Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment. Hey everyone, happy Friday and happy pre-Memorial Day weekend. This is a part of our expanded coverage, thanks to all of our amazing Supercast subscribers. So as you know, because you're listening to this on a Friday, we have added an episode a week, and that is because of the support we get from folks like yourselves. So if you have not got the chance to check out our offering, you can go to realignment.supercast.com, $5 a month, $50 a year, $500 for a lifetime membership, or click the link at the top of the show notes. Incredibly helpful for us as a show as we get bigger and expand. And once again, appreciate everyone who's done that already. So for today's episode, we've got a great conversation with Yoram Hazony. He's the author of Conservatism, A Rediscovery. This is a part of our series about ideologies in the mix as the American political system and the broader world realigns itself. So we had Sohrab Rahmari on 2 months ago. We had Michael Kazin on the left. Matthew Continetti came in at the start of the month to really talk about how the right's thinking about things. And then this book with Yoram is another example of that. Yoram is more to the Sohrab side than the Matthew Continetti side. But as you and all of our listeners are trying to figure out how we should think about new ideologies in a time like this, these debates are incredibly important. Now, Yoram is definitely probably not going to be exactly in agreement with everyone on the show, especially with the section we get into about the importance of school prayer in red states. But I think it's important that we as a show engage with all different perspectives, all different ideologies, and let them say their piece. We'd definitely love to hear what folks think about this. We've got a Substack coming out today, so you could definitely reply to that with your thoughts. All that said, really enjoyed this episode and hope you all enjoy it as well. Huge thank you to Lincoln Network for supporting our work. Here's the show. Yoram Hazony, welcome to The Realignment.
Thank you for having me. Pleasure to be on.
Yeah, great to chat with you about this really weighty but really important topic. Let's start with a question that listeners are likely going to have to any episode that we have that focuses on these ideas. We had Francis Fukuyama on a couple of weeks ago. We spoke with Matthew Continetti before that. We're speaking with you. We spoke with Michael Kazin about the left. Why do these big ideologies, these terms, conservatism, liberalism, why do they matter in the world of practical politics?
Well, people tend to form. I mean, this is something I go into in my new book on conservatism. People tend to form into groups, into loyalty groups, families, tribes, nations, parties, factions. And if you want to understand what's going on in any society, any political system, you want to know what are the groups, and you want to know what's their basic worldview. I mean, people often come at politics with kind of an individualist perspective. They think that, you know, every person thinks for themselves and can just freely come up with, you know, a new way of looking at things. To some extent, that's true, but to a very large degree, people adopt the positions, they adopt the framework that their tribe or party adopts, which is why when a couple of important people, two or three important people within a certain political or social group take a certain position, suddenly, you know, without any coordination, suddenly everybody in the group, almost everybody, is saying the same thing using almost the same words. So in political theory, you know, like in sociology, you want to know what are the groups, and you want to know what the basic framework is that they're using to approach the world. Because if you know the basic framework, then you can pretty much see where they're going to go on a whole lot of issues.
No, that's very helpful. And I think this also speaks to a frustration I have, let's say, with the gun control post Uvalde, Texas debate, where you have a lot of folks who look at this issue, let's say, from the left and say, all these conservatives oppose gun regulation. the NRA is giving them money. That explains why they're thinking the way they're thinking. When I think if you take a perspective of looking at conservatives as a group, looking at the underlying beliefs about individualism, risk, tolerance, those different bits, you would come up with a conclusion that suggests this isn't about the NRA handing everyone checks. So I mean, that's a really valuable way to put it. So let's speak to the group that you're really speaking to. Your book and your broad work has been about conservatism. But in this case, your book's title is actually deeply interesting beyond just the marketing. It's called Conservatism, a Rediscovery. The obvious question, what is being rediscovered?
Well, I think a whole lot of people, especially younger people, have been correctly asking, why call yourselves conservatives? You know, what have you succeeded in conserving? And I think that that's a question we hear an awful lot. And I think that it's right. If you take the story of America and you know, more generally the democratic countries after World War II, you start out, you know, in the 1930s and 40s, America is still a very deeply Christian country, and it sees its if we take FDR, for example, on the eve of World War II, says, you know, what is the coming conflict about? We're the God-fearing democracies. You know, he doesn't even use the word liberalism. He says that there are countries that are God-fearing, and America and Britain are going to lead those countries against the atheistic totalitarians. And if we then sort of go after World War II, we start to see a systematic rejection of religious and national tradition. And that, you know, it's obviously a result of the horrors of the two world wars, but with that, all sorts of traditional things get, you know, cast aside. First it's God and scripture, and later it's the idea of the independent nation and the traditional family. And later it gets down to, the binary between men and women, which comes under fire and starts to get thrown out. And so when people say, you know, how can you say you're a conservative? What have you conserved? I think that's exactly the right question. And what I aim to do with this book is to go back to an older philosophical and a political tradition, which focuses on the question, what do you actually need to do if you want to conserve and transmit anything great and good from one generation to the next? Because I think we've lost the ability in general to do that.
You know, it's interesting when you ask the question of what have you conserved, I was thinking about things, and I think most of my answers came down to probably economic policy. So conservatism, or of a conservative movement post-World War II, has largely, I think, post 1965 with the Great Society and with like an aberration like Obamacare, largely preserved or pulled back the real FDR, LBJ economic expansionism. So one could say that was an achievement. But I'm guessing when I'm looking at your articulation of what's not been conserved, so the nation, the traditional family, scripture, your priorities would probably lie more on the cultural side than the economic picture. Is that a way of articulating how you're thinking about this?
Well, I definitely think that division between people who think of the world in terms of economics and economic freedoms, and people who think of the world in terms of societies and culture and what's being handed down, I think that dichotomy really does exist among people who call themselves conservatives. I don't like to draw the line so sharply because, because an economy is also a cultural thing. I mean, it has material aspects to it. But, you know, if you ask a question like, well, up until the 1960s, the United States had a historic pattern from its founding of, you know, generally trying to pay off its debts and not run vast deficits that then can't be repaid. And that tradition was abandoned in the 1960s, that you could say tradition of what used to be called fiscal responsibility was abandoned at the same time that America was abandoning, you know, traditional constraints on pornography or abortion or divorce on lots of things. So I'm not sure that culture versus economics does justice to what we're seeing. I think what we're seeing is a general inability to preserve useful customs, even in the economic sphere. Let me give you another example that is in the economic sphere. The idea that companies have a responsibility to their nation, you know, you could call that cultural, but it has a huge economic impact, because if it used to be that it was assumed that an American company would have responsibilities to look out for America, you know, they could trade overseas, but there had to be some, you know, some limit to how much harm they were willing to do either to American security or to jobs, the ability of workers to find good jobs in the United States. I think that in the 1950s and 60s, even in the 70s, that was still assumed. It was a sort of a cornerstone of the American version of the economy. And somewhere along the line after that, economic elites convinced themselves that you know, that really, as long as people, as long as gross national product was going up, which means as long as somebody was making money in America, then it was just fine if the way that was done was by moving American manufacturing to China and building up this, you know, this fearsome opponent to the United States. And for a long time, people were saying, look, we're lifting people out of poverty in China, which was true. But I think in the old traditional America, building up China at America's expense would have been a red line that most business people wouldn't have been willing to cross.
I'm glad you gave that example specifically, because it gets to a question I'm sure listeners have about who exactly these conservatives are. Because, for example, your articulation of countries and elites having some type of duty to their country, I think that is a articulation that FDR and the folks at Ford and GE, who converted themselves into just like the leading industrial factor driving the US from World War II, would be quite comfortable with. And those people were FDR Democrats / liberals in the new American domestic political sense. So at what point do these ideas, these priorities, let's say like duty to country and to nation, family, et cetera, when do they become conservative? And when are they just a general idea that the broad consensus of a society agrees on?
Well, the things that are the ideas that are called conservative today, you know, they weren't conservative, you know, 200 or 300 years ago. You know, 200 or 300 years ago, they were just sort of the general inheritance of Christian English speaking nations. You know, along with the Bible and the belief in God and the common law, and you know, obviously, not every single person in these countries believed in, you know, all of the inherited things, but it was possible sort of at a national level to hand down assumptions like you know, that young people should look to get married and have children and to stay married, and that the family unit has a responsibility of national service. It has a responsibility of honoring God and religion. It has a responsibility of handing things down. Like, all of these things used to be a commonplace in Christian and Jewish culture as civilization. And today they're not. Today they are, to a very significant extent, passé. Where they're not passé, they're under fire. And so people are called conservatives when, you know, not so much when they want to, you know, defend what exists, as when they, a conservative is somebody who wants to restore some of the good things that we've lost. And I think if, you know, looking at where America is today, or Britain, I mean, I find it very difficult to understand. Are there people who think that America is in good shape right now? I meet almost nobody who thinks that America is in good shape. So why is it in bad shape? The neo-Marxist left, they have their answer. They know why America's in bad shape. It's, you know, it's because of systematic racism and sexism and homophobia and so on. I offer a different answer. I think that conservatives think that America's in bad shape because it's dissolving. There's such a thing as the bonds that hold the country together, that hold the different tribes within the nation together, the mutual loyalties. It's like the mutual loyalties that hold the family together. And when you come to visit a family that is dissolving, you know what it looks like. The bickering and jostling for status, you know, that always happens among kids and even happens between husbands and wives. And, you know, every family has arguments, but there's a strong family, when it comes under any kind of external pressure, when it faces challenges, or when there's, you know, like an important project underway, then, you know, all the fighting stops and people and everybody in the family join forces, and they're all on the same side, and they actually feel what one another are feeling. They feel the successes and defeats together, the joys and the grief. When you visit a family that is dissolving, where these ties of mutual loyalty are fraying and about to break, you know what it looks like. The fights become endless. They're never resolved. They become uglier and more vicious. And when a family like that comes under pressure from the outside, instead of everybody rallying around, you know, standing behind the parents, the husband standing behind his wife and the wife behind her husband, instead of that, things just get much worse. Everybody starts blaming one another and insulting one another. And that's a family that's on the way to divorce. And the same thing is true in larger loyalty groups, including nations. America is there. America is dissolving. And I would think that people who care about the United States and people who care about, you know, the West more generally, because I think if America goes, then a whole lot of other countries are going to go down with it. I think they have to be saying to themselves, what is it that makes it that allows cohesion? What is it that allows national unity? What is it that allows national forgiveness? And these are all conservative questions.
I really like the metaphor of the bickering family. I guess the one thing I would add to what you're saying, though, is that in this case, it's not merely that the family isn't able to stand up to these. Well, I guess it is that there are outside pressures on the family, but at the same time, there are also internal, right, deep internal conflicts that are, and it's an ecosystem, right? We're super mixing metaphors here, but this is all operating together. So I'd love for you just to articulate then, what are the external pressures that are impacting like this, like Anglo-American family?
Well, I was talking about a, you know, like, a specific family, a particular family that when it faces financial hardship or one of the kids is hospitalized in an accident, there can be all sorts of things. There can be alcoholism, which you're right, that's not an external pressure. It's a problem within the family itself. So I really just should have said any kind of strain on the resources of the family, an emotional strain, a financial strain. It could be the father, or mother losing their job, or some kind of conflict with the neighbors. I mean, you know, people can be in big, get into lawsuits, which can destroy a family. There's all sorts of pressures, and the thing to focus on is that there are some families that when things get hard, they have the resources to come together and be on the same side. And there are other families that when things get hard, they fight all the worse. They hate each other. You know, they blame each other for what happened. You wouldn't have lost your job if you hadn't been A, B, C, and D. Mm-hmm. She wouldn't have been drinking if it weren't for, the way you treated her. All of those things they make just as much sense, as pulling together. But there's an objective difference. One is a strong family, a cohesive family, and one is a dissolving family, a dissolute family. And the characteristic of a dissolving family is that the children are no longer able to give honor to their parents because their parents are fighting all the time, which is to say that the parents don't give honor to one another. Giving honor means you build up your partner. You're not constantly looking to criticize because you know that criticizing too much hurts, and so instead you are looking to make your wife feel like she's respected, like she's doing a good job. That doesn't mean that you never criticize, but in general, people love people when they feel honored, and they come to hate people when they don't feel honored. And that means that honor is the most important tool that any of us have for keeping a family together, for keeping a nation together. And the fact that that in a post-religious society, almost nobody talks about honor. Almost nobody talks about. Almost nobody teaches honor. And then people want to know why. Why they can't get marriages to work.
It's interesting. I'm curious, I think it's really helpful that you set this up. And this is truly, I think, a truly everyone, no matter what their political identity, could agree with the way you frame this. There is so much feeling across aisles, ideologies, whatever, that the country is dissolving in some sense. You said specifically why you do not think the, let's say, like further left articulation, placing race, gender debates at the very center of this isn't the proper solution or answer to this dissolution. Why, though, do you not think that this post-1960s fusionist conservatism, what folks would traditionally think of as the right, why is that not the proper response to the country's dissolution. And of course, I'd love for you just to basically define the folks who you're critiquing, which is slightly right. unfair, but also you're a political philosopher, so I think you're up to the task.
No, completely fair question. I should just say, you know, for starters, on Buckley and the Confucianist movement, that I said Confucianist. that was some slip.
Buckley, you could have been coining a term, so I was going to let it go.
Well, maybe I just did, but I meant to just say Buckley and the Fusionist movement. So Fusionist conservatism from the 1960s. The first thing to say about it is that it really was immensely successful, and it has two spectacular achievements. That I think it's wrong to deny it. I mean, I think it just achieved two vast things. One, which you already mentioned, is that the post 1960s alliance between libertarians and conservatives that Buckley masterminded, that alliance did roll back socialism in American Britain and other countries for an entire generation. And even more important, it was the set of ideas that propelled Reagan and Thatcher to power, and that defeated the Soviet Union. I mean, there really was for an entire generation after the Second World War, almost two generations. There really was a threat of a communist. Hegemony over the world, and that was eliminated and defeated by these fusionist ideas. So first of all, I want to give them their due. In their time and place, they were incredibly successful and did good things, but now it's a generation later, and I think we have to ask tough questions about how we got here. And fusionism, understanding fusionist conservatism, is part of the answer of how did we get here. The deal between libertarians or liberals, between the freedom oriented, economic oriented side of the conservative movement of the 1960s and what's called the traditionalists, the people who are worried about issues of conservation and transmission from one generation to the next. The deal that was struck between them was roughly that the public face of fusionism, its political theory in terms of government policy, would be based on liberalism, on individualism, on a worldview of let's emphasize the rights and freedoms of the individual. And you can see how that's useful when you're fighting socialists and communists. It gives you a good answer. But then where's the conservative part? You know, where's the life of conservation and transmission that is what makes it possible for you to keep your nation together and keep it going from one generation to the next? Well, the answer that the fusionists gave is basically that everything in that sphere needs to be privatized. So, everything having to do with religion is a matter for the family, parents to teach their children. Everything that has to do with morals, everything that has to do with things like love of country and historical awareness and belonging, it all gets privatized. And what we've discovered in the 60 years since then is that when the public sphere becomes liberal, when it becomes neutral, when it becomes emptied of the old Christian and biblical framework in which people led their lives, what happens is that things that are not honored in public also end up not being honored in private. You can't send kids to schools. I mean, I don't know if everybody knows this, that American schools could have prayer in the schools, they could teach Bible in the schools up until the 1960s. And the idea was that this stuff doesn't have to be in school because America is a religious country and, kids will get it at home and in church in a couple of hours on Sunday. And that completely failed. That simply wasn't true at all. You cannot send children 5 days a week, all day long, for their most productive hours, to sit in classrooms that have been stripped clean of any reference to God or the biblical foundation of society, and then expect that the kids who see the teachers dishonoring religion by its absence every day, all day long, you can't expect the kids to think, oh, well, I should honor religion, you know, because on Sunday I go to church. I mean, that's just not what happened. And so at this point, I think those parts of the United States where there's, you know, where there's still a Christian majority, or at least, let's say, a pro-Christian majority, a majority that thinks, well, we have to have a framework for our society, and we don't want the woke left to give us the framework. And post-World War II liberalism has collapsed. I mean, it's just completely, in 2020, it just collapsed in ignominious defeat at the hands of its Marxist opponents. So the only alternative that I think is strong enough to fight this woke tide is going to be a Christian-based framework, some kind of restoration of public Christianity. Obviously, there's lots of places in America where that's, you know, absurd. That's a, you know, a total non-starter. But I'm talking about, you know, what should happen in those states where there's still a pro-Christian majority, where if you ask people, seeing where we've gotten, is a Christian public culture a better framework? I think there's plenty of states in the United States where people would at this point be willing to say, yes, let's give that a try. In those places, I think that fusionism needs to be rejected. The public culture can't be liberal and it can't be neutral. We already tried that and it failed. So, I think the right thing to do is to restore biblical religion to a framework position within societies where, you know, where there's still a majority that wants that.
You know, it's really interesting, especially because of the fact that you are obviously, well, this isn't obvious to folks who don't know your background or to people who are not watching this, who are listening, but you're Jewish. So yeah. You could answer this question very, very importantly and very specifically. Why are you, as a Jew, comfortable with, I don't want to say Christian domination, but the framework you're essentially describing? Because it wasn't as if it was just 1960s radicals who were pushing against
not
Christian majority. There were plenty of religious minorities, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, who did not like that very Christian-centric domination of the public sphere, spaces like schools, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Why are you ultimately in the 2020s comfortable as a Jew articulating a Christian-dominated, and once again, domination as a connotation to it, but why are you comfortable with this as a Jew?
Well, look, I'm not 100% comfortable. You know, there are very big differences between Christianity and Judaism, and in a different context, you know, I'd be happy to be discussing why, you know, why Judaism is a better idea. But we're not talking about like some kind of theoretical fantasy world where we can do whatever we want. Christianity has a massive advantage over every other system of thought that it's competing with seriously in Western countries. And that advantage is that it has the Bible. And the Bible provides a framework both for national independence and for public morals, which America desperately needs. You know, it's not going to happen because just because it's a good theory or a bad theory. It's going to happen if it happens because people look at where we've come and they see and they say, okay, the Christian past is, you know, certainly has lots and lots of flaws to it. There's lots of things we could complain about, but it's not clear that any of those flaws rival the disintegration and moral chaos and even violence that that America has experienced in the last couple of years and that is increasing and will continue to increase. People who are willing to place the biblical framework for a positive and constructive public life on the agenda, those people are my allies, and they're my allies, they're my friends, and I've also spent an awful lot of years talking to Christians. I have some kind of sense of, I think, of where Christianity stands today. People think about, people use words like, naturally words like domination, come to mind if you're thinking about centuries where Christianity was the framework. And I think that I think that when you meet Christian leadership, both the older people and the younger people today, you're basically talking about, not a victorious triumphalist religion, which is has great confidence in imposing its ideas on everybody. I think almost the opposite is true today. That most of the Christian leadership that I know is chastened, if not defeated. The feeling in the Christian community, I think, is much more. We can't even transmit Christianity to our own children. How are we going to tell other people how to live their lives? That shift from a sort of a triumphant Christianity that felt that it had all the answers to a defeated Christianity, which is scared to fight, is embarrassed to fight, is embarrassed to stand up for even the things that are most precious to it. I think it's a terrible condition. It's a terrible sight. And I don't have any problem telling my Christian friends, look, it's time for you to get over your self-imposed sense of defeat and to get up and fight. I mean, who else is going to fight? I'm trying to be, absolutely realistic about this. Who else is going to fight this wave that is destroying America and the West? From what I have seen, the strong Christian communities, both Protestant and Catholic, they are the best. They're the people who are most capable of seeing clearly, the people who are most willing to take risks. They're the people who are most appalled by the fact that that liberal Americans have just, most of them have just given up the fight and handed the reins over to these Marxists. So what other choice is there? And I'm comfortable saying that there is no other choice. Our Christian brothers are going to have to take up this fight, and they're going to have to take the lead. And if they don't, there's nobody to replace them.
I've got a couple responses. I think the first question I'll ask you, and I do not like bringing up Donald Trump because it's kind of obvious and kind of boring, but I think it's deeply important to your framework here. So you are placing biblical ideas, these concepts of honor at the center of your diagnosis of the problems facing the country.
Yep.
And the awkward dynamic with Trump here is that Obviously, this is why I don't like talking about it. Trump is not a honorable man. Obviously, Trump does not, at a familial level, at a friendship level, basically any level, he does not embody the ideals you're talking about. However, and this is why the past 7 years make a lot of sense, despite all that, and in some ways, because of that lack of honor, willingness to break these rules, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, if you are a social conservative in this country, you have him to thank for pro-life justices on the Supreme Court and the probable overturning of Roe v. Wade. You have him to thank for the fact that the conservative movement, or let's just say, let's put aside that and just say the Republican Party, is probably fighting, to your point of what you just said here, is more likely to fight because he's modeled fighting as an effective method. There's a reason why GOP governors and senators are 100 times more aggressive towards the various forces of the center and the left that you're describing. And that's because of Trump's model. So how do we reconcile that bit there?
I don't find it so. I mean, I just don't see it as so difficult. Human beings are flawed. I mean that's a traditional Christian and Jewish message. That's a biblical message. I mean, there are no heroes. You know, from all of the successful leaders, men and women that you see described in the Hebrew Bible, all of them are described with flaws. Every single one of them is described with failings, larger or smaller. So Moses's failings are pretty minor, but there are leaders like, I mean, you know, the most famous is Jephthah, who Iftach in Hebrew. He's this son of a prostitute. He's introduced in scripture as being, you know, hanging out with all these worthless men, and the elders turn to him when the country is being invaded, just because there are no other leaders. They need somebody who's willing to fight, so they take this guy who's basically a coarse ruffian. And later we actually get to see him, you know, sacrifice his daughter. Like he actually kills his own daughter to sacrifice her to God. I mean, this is insane, grotesque stuff. But in a general, the Talmud comments that Jephthah in his generation was like Samuel in his generation. You know, there's this horribly decadent leader for his generation. He was like, you know, one of the most flawless and selfless of leaders of a different generation. In other words, you have to fight with what you have. And Trump was willing to do what he did, you know, to take on the entire liberal establishment, both Democratic Party and Republican Party. He was willing to take them all on because he's an outsider, and to a certain degree, he just doesn't care what any of these people think of him. I think that we can afford to, you know, to call it just like it is, that like many people, he's flawed. He's a flawed person. And many of the ways in which he's flawed are especially uncomfortable to conservative and religious people. And at the same time, it's not clear that anyone would have done what he did. So we should be really grateful for what he did. And my answer to people who are serious conservatives, who don't like Trump because of the way he talks or the way he treats people or any of these other things, is put up better leadership. I mean, that's the simple answer is take him as an inspiration for the good things he did and reject the you know, the not just the court coarseness, but for example, the unwillingness to cooperate with a peaceful transition after the election. You know, I think it was very bad for America. I think it was, but so put up better leadership. Come on, let's go. Show that you can fight like he can.
You know, it's interesting. I just want to put a quick cap on this thing, because I think what I'm refining my question down to is, so I agree to your point about, okay, put up better leaders. It's not as if, you know, institutions or interest groups specifically saying, I want a person who cheats on his wife. I want a person that no one, literally no one think, left, right, or center, no one thinks that way. I'm curious about the individual leaders themselves. So for example, let's look at Eric Greitens, former governor of Missouri, also Jewish. Not that's particularly relevant, just noting it. This is a person who in many ways has taken this Trumpian lesson to be that, hey, like, as long as I fight, I can essentially do whatever I want and not have to apologize. And I think tactically, I understand where that's coming from. But I guess, what do you say to leaders themselves then who see Trump offering them a window into justifying allowing them to be their worst selves? So I get 100% like why it's up to Christians, social conservatives to say, like, what do you say to individual leaders?
I don't think Trump gives people a justification for being their worst selves. I think that if Trump had been capable restraining the worst of his tendencies to be divisive, and had been just a bit more capable of giving honor to the other guy, to people who didn't agree with him, he would have been reelected. I mean, the election was incredibly close, and it was lost by just in exactly those circles of people who want somebody who will be capable of doing some unifying and not just dividing. By the way, it's not like Biden is any better at this. I mean, look, Trump was correct in identifying a lot of crucial issues that other people didn't see. He wanted to put the nation back at the center when it had disappeared. He was willing to see traditional religion and morality, even if it's funny to say it, but he's willing to see that as part of the American inheritance that makes America strong. And that's why he allied himself with, he looked for alliance with Christian conservatives. And all of that is what America needs, but it needs somebody who can also do more unifying. And that is the responsibility of a national leader. It is to win the election, to pick his fights, but also when he's fighting against, you know, against a rival group, his job is to find a way to bring the hatred level down.
Yeah, and I think the helpful thing to your point is it's not as if Trump's dishonor in this context wasn't without consequence. That obvious consequence for him is it lost him the election. So the claim is not, I think I was a little too forward in basically saying the clear lesson from Trump is that as a politician, you can do anything. Like that obviously just isn't true. And I think skilled and talented politicians can recognize that. So I've got three last questions before we're at the hour. I'm really interested in your articulation of the prayer in school in Christian context. I think the part I want to push on is the schools that were up until the 1960s facilitating school prayer. That was at a time when schools, institutions, governments, et cetera, were at the height of their post-World War II credibility. The teachers themselves were probably the most likely to be religious and engaged in those type of like civic duties that they've ever, that they ever would have been. And that just no longer exists. So I think what I'm curious about is, let's just be totally, because this is a philosophical conversation. I don't need to say, how do you pass the bill? That's not quite as helpful here. But let's say you could just, you know, fiat that that happens. Does school prayer work in a society where the teacher and the institution of the school itself lacks the credibility that it once had at the height in, let's say, the 50s and the 60s?
Well, look, I'm not suggesting that that we drop school prayer on communities where most people don't understand why you would do it and most people don't want it. My argument is about how communities that are still conservative, what they should do and how they can go forward. And the separation of church and state, that a theory which was imposed in 1947 by the Supreme Court on all the states for the first time in American history. In 1948, the theory of separation of church and state was used to ban a practice that most American states, I think, had at the time, which was giving students a choice of religion instruction in the schools from a Protestant or a Catholic or a Jewish perspective. This was in the Chicago school system, and it was ruled unconstitutional to allow students an option, you know, one of three options for, you know, for what, who to study religion from. And I think that was a terrible mistake. It was a terrible wrong turn in American history. At this point, what we're talking about is a regime of forced secularization, forced liberalization. Kids are required by law to go to schools, and the schools are not allowed to teach the parents values. And that has created a vacuum, and into that vacuum, this new religion of woke neo-Marxism has stepped in. So what I'm arguing for, and this isn't just philosophical, I think that this is a practical proposal. I think that those states that are that still have enough of the inheritance to be able to conceive of public religion as a positive good that helps them raise their children, those states should step out from under the imposed liberalization and secularization, which has failed, and should go back to a more conservative system. Now, different states will come up with different theories, and if this happens, then we'll see experiments with it in different places, and then we'll find out, you know, just how accommodating can these Christians really be? I mean, that, you know, the accusation is it's going to be like Ayatollahs running Iran. Well, if that's true, then it's not going to get very far. But I don't understand why any Christian or any decent person at this point in America would not say, all right, let's let them try it. Let's see what they can do. Let's see if it's possible for Catholics and Protestants to collaborate with one another. Let's see if they're capable of being tolerant and decent and creating a better framework for us to live in. My sense is that is possible. Otherwise, I wouldn't be proposing it. But the only way to know is to try it.
So, second to last question here. I was when you were describing just the post-60s fusionist focus on the individual, and then you were describing this post-2020 period. I was just writing this down because I'm thinking about a couple of these issues that have been like post-2016. You know, whether they are COVID restrictions, the EU, basically like multilateral institutions, or, you know, transnational institutions imposing their will on individual countries, the gun rights debate, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. conservative tactical victories on these issues have really been framed in individualistic terms.
Yeah.
So I'm curious how you think about that balancing act, like dynamic. Like even on these, even on CRTs and wokeness in school, the rhetoric is this crazy teacher is telling your kid what to think about this. You don't think about that, push back against it. So I'm curious how you just think about this like dynamic with the tactics versus like the top line.
Look, when America was a healthy country, it always had an individualist left, you know, that represented at the founding by people like Jefferson and Paine, and it always had a nationalist or communitarian conservative stream, which was basically at the founding was the Federalist Party of Washington and Jay and Hamilton and Adams. And I think that the tension between those two parties was healthy and productive. Excuse me. And at this point, that second wing, that more conservative wing, is defeated and almost silent. And in order to return to health, if that's possible, it's going to happen because the conservative nationalist or communitarian wing is going to assert itself and rapidly gain prominence. I think that the re-injection of nationalism in the Trump years is hopefully the beginning of a much more systematic and much more acceptable version of that. And I just, you know, there is no salvation for, you know, political salvation for a country that whose only choices are radical individualism or Marxist dictatorship. That's neither of those are acceptable answers.
So for my last question, I'll just give you a real softball here and reference your previous most recent book, The Virtue of Nationalism, that's somewhere on this bookshelf back here. I think how quickly nationalism has gone from a dirty word to just being a widely accepted topic, I think in the period since your book has been written, it's been really fascinating. Some of the biggest nationalists I know are now center-left people with Ukraine flags in their Twitter bios. They wouldn't quite identify themselves as like thinking of the nation as important, but you know, they'll say things like the UN can't do anything. I'm skeptical of the WHO. Just like this entire post-COVID period has, I think, enabled people to move beyond, like you said, so much of nationalism's discourse being stuck in the 1930s and 1940s, and think of it as a logical solution to a lot of the problems we're facing. So can you just close with just a quick, just update us on how you're thinking about the topic, because you've consistently mentioned that throughout the episode. I think it's a helpful place to throw viewers next after they consume your most recent book.
Yeah, sure. I mean, in my new book on conservatism, one of the things I do is I discuss the preamble to the American Constitution, which was not written by an individualist. It was written by Governor Morris, who's one of the leaders of the Federalist Party, and a really serious conservative. And it begins, the first aim of American government, according to the American Constitution, is to form a more perfect union among the diverse parts of the country. the expression general welfare, to ensure the general welfare, is not an individualist statement. It's a reflection of the idea that that a nation is a union, and it does have a welfare, and that welfare depends on a proper balance of honors among the different parts of the different parts of the national community. That's the only, I think that simply expresses a traditional conservative view. The blessings of liberty are in there. They're crucial. They're a goal of government, but they're only one of the seven goals of government in the preamble. And so conservatives don't want to try to reduce everything to a single principle. Any one principle, if you take it to the end and you make it the ultimate principle, is going to end up being first utopian and then insane, and it'll destroy the country. A real conservative politics is based on balance, finding balance among those principles. And at this point in history, America has gone way too far in the direction of individual liberties. Individual liberties cannot be a justification for, you know, for flooding the country with pornography, so that, you know, every child has pornography, you know, in their lives and shaping who they are. That's taking individual liberty too far. You can't have run a country where freedom of speech is suppressed by monopolistic private corporations. That's taking private rights too far. There has to be some limit. And I think conservatives of this generation can see that those limits need to be imposed, and the proper criterion for deciding. You know, where do you put a limit to private liberties, is the traditional criterion of the national interest or the common good of the nation. There is such a thing as the common good of the nation, and that has to be used in order to restrain individual liberties, in order to be able to hold everything together into the future.
Yoram, thank you so much for joining us on The Realignment, and I really suggest that everyone check out Conservatism, A Rediscovery. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you, Marshall. God bless.
Reminder, Substack, subscription, bookshop, book purchases, and of course, huge thank you to Lincoln Network for supporting our work. We'll see you next time.